This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to Peoples and Things, where we explore human life with technology. I'm Lee Vinsel. You know, the topic of race and technology has always been very important to me. But historically, whenever I've attempted to bring this topic into any of the classes I've taught, but especially the class I've taught for many years on the history of the automobile in the United States, I have run into the same frustrating roadblock. For example, when prepping that class, I would look into the scholarverse and ask, what do we know about black people and cars? And the answer would come back, nothing. I would find that nearly zero research had been published on that topic or on any other consideration of race and technology. Now, luckily, in recent years, this has been changing. Continuing to focus on cars for a second, there are several books that already have been, or we hope will be, on the podcast, including Mia Bay's Traveling Black, Gretchen Soren's Driving While Black, and Sarah Seo's Policing the Open Road. But there's still so much to do. How do we do it? When I would do the most basic research into these topics for the classes, like put in terms for various technologies into databases of African American newspapers, I would find a wealth of knowledge that no one had written about yet. Like, historians have not bothered to do even the most cursory research into these topics. Maybe that is sadly unsurprising. But once we get past that basic stuff, then things get interesting because groups that have been marginalized in society often do not end up in the kinds of archives and databases that humanities and social science scholars tend to rely on. This is a famous and old problem. So you have to get creative. Well, what does that look like? One set of answers comes from the book we cover in today's episode, Riding Jane Crow, African American Women on the American Railroad by Mariam Thagard, a professor of English at the University of Buffalo. Thagard examines how black women experienced the railroad as passengers and as workers from the mid-19th to the mid-20th century. Along the way, she creatively pulls on many different kinds of sources to draw out the experiences of these women. In one interesting example, she reconstructs the daily lives of black waiter carriers, women who would bring and sell to passengers fried chicken and other prepared foods, and she uses drawings and photographs of these women to try and get a sense of what their lives were like. And the book is full of things like this. I had a great time talking with Mariam, and I learned a lot from her. Hey, get excited.
Thank you.
My guest today is Mariam Thagart, professor of English at the University of Buffalo. Today, we'll be talking about her book, Writing Jane Crow, African-American Women in the American Railroad, as well as some of her other work. Mariam, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to speak with you.
So Writing Jane Crow is a neat book. When you explain it to strangers, what do you say about it? What were you trying to do with it?
Well, I usually start off by telling people it's about Black women and the American Railroad. And I usually get people kind of startled because most people haven't thought about that particular connection. And I just tell them that I was curious about how Black women experienced the railroad throughout history, throughout the 19th and 20th century. Mm-hmm. And from there, I always get questions about, well, how did they experience it? Is it similar to African-American men? You know, what were their differences? So I think most people are just kind of surprised because they haven't really thought about that particular connection between Black women and this really important form of transportation.
Mm-hmm. How did you come to write it? I mean, how did you kind of get started down this? I don't know. I won't make too many railroad metaphors while we're doing this. But like, how did you get started down the tracks towards this book?
Well, you know, I was doing some work at the Newberry Library in Chicago.
I love that place.
It's really wonderful. Yeah, I love it. It's a wonderful library and public library. Anyone can go in and do research there. So I was doing some research on the Pullman porters, I came across some information about a woman who was applying to be a Pullman maid. I guess I should mention that the Newberry Library is really unique in that it has a really large archive on the Pullman Company, which is this really important train company in the 19th century, late 19th century. Mm-hmm. And they were really famous for their Pullman porters, African-American men who provided service to passengers in the Pullman compartment. They're very well-known labor group. So I was just really surprised when I came across this file that had a photograph of an African-American woman, had her application. And I was just curious about, you know, who was this woman? You know, how did the Pullman Company employ African-American women? And I think most importantly, I was curious about why I had never heard of the Pullman Company maid. And that particular question just led me to think in more expansive terms about Black women, the railroad, and how there's this really large absence, I think, in our collective knowledge about the train and African-American women. I think the train has such an important resonance in our sort of understanding about the United States and the American nation.
Yeah.
But when you think about those sort of national narratives about the train in U.S. culture, very rarely do we think about how African-American women intersected with this form of movement. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the main things I was trying to tackle in the book. Just, you know, one, what were the experiences of Black women like in the 19th and early 20th century? And two, trying to come to some sort of understanding about, you know, why that question hasn't really been asked as frequently when we talk about the railroad in the United States.
And what got you looking at Pullman in the first place? What were you initially thinking you were looking for in that archive?
Well, my past work focused on African-American modernism. And I was thinking for a future project that I would do something on technology and African-Americans. And so I was planning to investigate African-Americans and things like the telegraph, the telephone, and of course, the railroad.
Yeah.
And so my work at the Newberry initially was in an effort to sort of figure out what I wanted to study in terms of African Americans and technology.
That's
cool. So I just sort of...
We still need that book, by the way. Someone needs to write that other book you're starting down there.
It's there in the, hopefully in the pipeline.
Good. I love that. I'm very excited to hear that. I really feel like we could just systematically go through all these major modern technologies and just look at the Black experience because it's so often just not written about, you know? I mean, there's Mia Bay, there's you, there's folks, there's Gretchen Soren. We now have these histories coming out, but there's still so much to do. So, yeah.
Right, exactly. And I know your work also deals with travel and technology. So, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, one of the places you start in the intro is just like looking at, you kind of just show the gap in the literature. So you look at Leo Marx's The Machine in the Garden, this very famous history of technology, and how it fits into American culture and meaning and symbolism and such. And then Wolfgang Schivelbusch's The Railroad Journey, another very famous book on railroads. And like, you know, just like the Black experience is elided in these things, very briefly mentioned. But Black women are barely there at all, right? I mean, is this what you find when you look at the literature?
Yeah, and I think with those two particular examples, it was really, quite obvious or evident to me that there was a absence of, if not African-Americans in general, definitely African-American women.
Yeah.
And I should note, you know, both Marx and Schivelbusch recently passed.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
I didn't put that together, though. I mean, I knew they each died fairly recently. But yeah, I didn't even think about the connection there when I was reading your book. That's interesting.
Yeah, I think Marx passed away last year.
Yeah.
And Schivelbusch passed away probably a couple of weeks or
a couple of months at most ago. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, these are two very influential examinations of the railroad.
Yeah.
And I really love Schivelbusch because the way he talks about the sort of subjective experience of riding the railroad. I mean, if anything, I was trying to sort of tap into that sort of subjective experience. And I think his book provided a kind of model for, speaking about those more ephemeral elements of technology. So I love both of their works, but I was just really troubled by the absence of Black women. And, you know, I was just curious about how would their arguments be revised or reshaped if Black women somehow made it into their pages.
Mm-hmm. I think the way you reconstruct the subjective experience of women in this book is really interesting. And you do it in a whole bunch of ways we're going to kind of hop through as we move on. Can you say a bit about something you emphasize in your introduction is that the whole Black story is one of mobility and movement going way back before the railroad. So can you set that up for us a bit that, you know, it's true that this is a new technology. It's a very important technology. There's a lot of movement going on before this technology. So tell us about the Black experience of mobility. Yeah.
Yeah. I think mobility is so pivotal to African-Americans and their construction of self. I think mobility in and of itself is important for the American citizen. And so I start off by just highlighting, the different ways in which the railroad reappears in African-American culture from something like the Underground Railroad, you know, this term for the movement of fugitive slaves from South to North. I also look at how the railroad impacts our understanding of Black music, blues, poetry. And then I just make note of the fact that for at different moments in African-American history, African-Americans have somehow been denied this freedom of movement. So of course, during slavery, where the mobility of those who were enslaved were very highly surveilled. Mm-hmm. Then if we look at Reconstruction, we have the development of Black codes, which regulated the movement of African-Americans in public space. And then, of course, post-Reconstruction, where we have a lot of violence directed towards African-Americans, especially African-Americans who wanted to ride in first-class train cars. Mm-hmm. So I just think a different sort of, there are different sort of inflection points in Black history where African-Americans wanted to assert their right to be citizens of this country. And one way in which that citizenship was attempted to be denied was by circumscribing their movement, mm-hmm. either in public space, in transportation spaces, and in different ways, Black citizenship has been somehow curtailed by limiting their freedom of movement.
Mm-hmm. You write briefly about it, but you do write about how the railroad shows up in blues songs, and I really liked that little where you did that. So can you tell us a bit about that? I mean, what is the railroad in blues music, you know? And you're saying there's a couple different kinds of stories we see in blues songs about trains, right?
Right. So we definitely see it in blues songs where singers might talk about the train as a form of escape. So jumping on the railroad to perhaps leave an unfaithful partner, mm-hmm. To escape some sort of harsh environment. I make the note of how Black female blues singers sort of have this complicated relationship to the train. And this is something that Hazel Carby and Angela Davis actually speak more about how the train appears in the lyrics of some of the blues songs that are sung by Black female blues singers like Bessie Smith, mm-hmm. Clara Smith, just different individual singers. So yeah,
that's cool.
I think, and that's actually one of the places where I saw Black female, I guess we could say pleasure with the train. That was another one of my questions. It seemed like for a number of African-American women, their experiences on the train have been so tense that it was very rare for me to find moments of fun, mm-hmm. Pleasure.
Chivalbush and these other writings, which is like there is a lot of people like, other folks are writing about the fun of trains, so it stands out here that you're not finding that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You write, I mean, one of the things you emphasize in the introduction that it plays out in the chapters is you found it helpful to look at the first class train compartment as a space. Mm-hmm. So why was that a helpful space to focus on for the story you wanted to examine?
I think the first class train car, it's important both as a physical space, but also as a kind of metaphor for the way in which African Americans are treated on this particular form of transportation. So first class train cars were so much better than second class train cars, better upholstery, it's cleaner, people act better. Mm-hmm. There's a sort of protocol of etiquette, I guess you could say. Those African Americans who could afford a first class ticket, you know, they would want to ride in a first class train car. Because of the sort of amenities that are available there. But of course, and especially in the late 19th century, post-Reconstruction, African Americans riding the first class train cars were sometimes forced off, sometimes very violently. I think especially when we think about Black women, there are train cars, first class train cars known as lady spaces, which were train cars sort of set up to appeal to the female traveler, primarily middle class or upper class white female travelers. When Black women wanted to ride in these first class lady spaces, they were forced off. Mm-hmm. Most famously is Ida B. Wells, mm-hmm. who was forced off in Tennessee. And so I think just having a Black woman occupy the space of a lady space, and then when we think about all of these sort of cultural suggestions, I guess, associated with that particular word of lady, a term that has not readily been applied to African-American women in our history. Mm-hmm. I think it was really important for Black women who could afford the first class lady space or a first class ticket. You know, if they could afford the ticket and they purchased a ticket, they wanted to ride in the first class space. The fact that some of these women were forced off led to these lawsuits in which Black women tried to assert their legal right to ride in this particular space that has been reserved for quote unquote ladies. So I think the first class train car mm-hmm. is it's a space of a lot of potential confrontations. Mm-hmm. It's the ability to ride in the first class space, I think, is a sign of respectability, a sign of somehow achieving a level of success. And, you know, being able to ride in that first class space would be a way to have others recognize a person's level of accomplishment. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, it's a little bit similar to our first class spaces on airplanes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a certain cachet, yeah. I guess you could
That's
say.
That's what I was going to use too.
You're riding in first class plane spaces. Yeah. And just being able to ride unmolested, you know, just to get from one space to another without worrying about being harassed or being thrown off or, you know, possibly being killed.
Yeah.
Because you're riding in space.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, I mean, you kind of perfectly led to my next question was you coined this idea of situational riding, which is that Black experiences depend a lot on who else is present. So play that out for us. What I mean, what's that allow us to see about the experience of these women?
Well, I think so much of the Black train riding experience was very contingent upon so many factors. One, would a white conductor object
right.
to having a Black person riding in a particular space? Would the conductor somehow force a Black passenger out of a first-class train car if a white passenger complained? Mm-hmm. You know, would there be white passengers who would want to get a Black passenger off? So I think so much of the train riding experience for Black people was really, there's a large sense of uncertainty.
Yeah.
Because even if you study the laws, the segregation laws, you know, some states did not, some states and also some train lines did not follow segregation rules mm-hmm. For, you know, all train cars and all places. So there's just so much, there was so much uncertainty and contingency involved with riding a train as a Black person. That's why I called it sort of the situational moment, just depending upon, you know, who's in the car with you. And sadly, like, you know, were they having a bad day that day?
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
It just depends on who else. No, it must've been
extremely stressful, right? I mean, just the tension yes. and anxiety, the thing, like you don't know what you're walking into, literally.
Right. Anxiety provoking. It's just that level of constantly being on guard. Mm-hmm. That was something I also wanted to sort of raise. And a number of people have asked me if, you know, if I see any sort of resonance to, you know, contemporary issues. And I think in one sense, one thing I do see a connection to is, you know, the we've seen so readily recently how any sort of encounter an African-American person may have with law enforcement,
right?
That sort of uncertainty about what can happen, yep. Some sort of innocuous event can somehow end in the death of another person.
Yeah.
I mean, I recognize the differences, of course. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I do think that sense of not knowing, you know, any wrong movement can somehow end up harming, you know, a person just trying to go about his or her day. I think that sort of sense of not having full control over what could happen to you, I think that uncertainty and anxiety is definitely something I see with more contemporary events.
Yeah, I totally hear what you're saying. And I see it too. So your first chapter examines the writings of Black intellectual, female intellectuals who talk about trains. So there's Anne Julia Cooper, Mary Church Terrell, and then a little bit of Ida B. Wells too. And so, you know, you've kind of just spelled out for us like the experience, right? That Black women so often had because it was so, you know, there's so much tension and uncertainty there. I mean, how did these women's writings allow you to kind of flesh that picture out?
Yeah, I was really curious how so many of these Black female intellectuals at the time somehow reference their difficulties traveling by train.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other female authors I could have included. I made a brief reference to Frances Harper. There was this repetitive concern about being able to travel and not be harassed in some way.
Yeah.
And so the fact that so many of them reference that particular experience, I think, is important because it becomes very fundamental to how they talk about their work, how they present themselves to other people. And so with Anna Julia Cooper, for example, in her book, A Voice from the South, I think it's very significant that, you know, she talks about what they call national courtesy, you know, being able to be respected when she travels far from home. And one of Anna Julia Cooper's most famous passages from that book is when she walks into a train station waiting room, and she states that she sees two different signs, one sign for ladies, another sign for colored people, and she wonders under which sign should I enter. And a number of people have taken that moment as a sort of early articulation of intersectionality, where the two signs seem to they don't really allow for the multiple elements that make up her identity as an African-American woman.
Hmm.
And I think also when we take a look at, say, someone like Mary Church Terrell, who, you know, not only wrote about her train travel experiences in her autobiography, but also makes references to her difficulties in her diaries. She wrote this short story that was never published, but was very much based upon her own experiences traveling by train as a college student and being harassed.
Mm-hmm.
I think the fact that so many of the Black women writing and lecturing during the late 19th century, the fact that so many of them talked about the train experience and how it impacted them personally, I think it's an important sort of paradigm that sort of shapes their writings and how they talk about trying to, quote unquote, uplift the race.
Can you say a bit about your second body chapter is about lawsuits around ladies' cars. And you've already kind of talked about it with harassment that these women focus. But can we just kind of, for listeners that don't know, I mean, like, what the meaning of the ladies' car was? I mean, why was it there? You know, why did it exist? And what was the meaning of it in culture generally?
Well, I think the ladies' car was a certain kind of first-class car. Sort of presented to female travelers so that they wouldn't have to worry about being approached by strange men, possibly being scammed or have items pilfered from their person. So it was a very sort of protective space, a space that was comfortable for people traveling from one place to another. And I think the whole concept of the ladies' car, you know, it signifies a level of respect, a level of deference given to the white middle class or upper class woman. There were a number of Black women who, when they tried to ride in the first class train car or a lady space, they were ejected. As I mentioned, Ida B. Wells is probably the most famous one. But there were other women who sued. And in some cases, these African-American women won their cases. And what's interesting is that a number of the women won their cases before Plessy versus Ferguson. And for those people who are really interested in this particular topic, I think a really good resource is Barbara Welke's. And of course, now I'm blanking on the title, but Barbara Welke is a legal scholar, a legal historian. And she has a whole book on some of these lawsuits that Black women initiated.
Okay. Well, she's kind of.
And one other thing.
I
should start off that chapter by looking at this sort of repeated scene of white men somehow mistakenly kissing.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that next. I'm glad you brought it up. So these, like, these films, right? You call them, they're called like race switching comedies.
Yeah. So, and what happens in them is that a Black woman and a white woman are somehow traveling together. There is a white man who is interested in somehow stealing a kiss from the white woman. The train enters a tunnel, and once the train exits the tunnel, we can see that somehow the white woman and the Black woman have switched places, and the white man ends up kissing the Black woman. And it's presented as a kind of comedy, but I also make the point that it's a comedy at the expense of the Black woman. And I think there's something about the ability of the Black and white woman to switch places. There was something about that that I think troubled people. The fact that a Black woman could possibly somehow occupy the space that is traditionally granted or given to white women.
In fact, you also make a large argument that that there's something about Black women moving, that there's a kind of sexualization of Black female mobility going on. And so tell us about that. I mean, how is it that, like, women, Black women are constantly being sexualized as travelers?
Yeah, there's, well, there are two different ways in which I tried to flesh this out. One was, I looked at a figure by the name of Jane Brown. Jane Brown was a light-skinned Black woman of Corinth, Mississippi. She tried to ride in the first-class train car, and the conductor forced her off very violently. She sued, and the conductor and the train line made the argument that the reason why she was forced off was because she was a prostitute, mm-hmm. that she was selling her services. Mm-hmm. And one of the main reasons why she had that sort of reputation was because she was frequently seen about the train station selling food to train passengers. And there was something about highly mobile Black women, mm-hmm. Women being present at these spaces of mobility that suggested some form of criminalization, that their movement somehow facilitated a transactional a sexual encounter.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to sort of flesh out that sense that highly mobile Black women, somehow there's a sort of threat
yep.
associated with that. And that in the most part, some form of that threat is of a sexual nature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You also had a chapter on these Black waiter carriers, which was totally new to me. There was another book on these folks earlier. Is that right?
That you were... Right. There's another book called Building Houses Out of Chicken Legs.
Okay.
By Psyche Williams Forson.
Okay.
And I've gotten that wrong. It might be Psyche Forson Williams. Uh-huh. But wonderful scholar at the University of Maryland, a food studies scholar.
Okay.
And her work first brought the experiences of waiter carriers to wider public attention. Mm-hmm. And waiter carriers were women who sold food to train passengers, stopped at a particular location before train cars had dining cars. Okay. And so they were really important for very hungry passengers
yeah.
who might not have brought food along with them on a train trip. And so I looked at how these waiter carriers in Gordonsville, Virginia, just probably about 20 minutes away from Charlottesville.
Okay.
How these waiter carriers developed a strong economic presence at a train station in Gordonsville. Mm-hmm. And their presence was so strong, in fact, that they were competition for some of the other eating establishments near the train station. And I look at their history, how they were forced to sell first from the platform, then they had to sell on the very train tracks.
Yeah.
And eventually they were banished from selling altogether, primarily because of a white politician who had a restaurant
okay.
Near the train station and didn't want to have to compete with their sales.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, a very an important element of Black women and the train, but I think not as widely known.
Yeah.
As
I thought it was cool. And you had so many neat sources. There's a lot of cool imagery throughout the whole book, but I really love the imagery in this chapter, especially, and how it kind of allowed you to draw out kind of like the, you start from the images, but then you try to reconstruct like what's going on from their point of view, right? Is that fair?
Yeah. And I think I'm very visually oriented. Mm-hmm. I think my previous work has examined photography and artwork. And I was just curious about, you know, some of the visual mm-hmm. representations of Black women in the train. And I think particularly in that chapter, we have some really great photographs of the women selling from the train tracks. One of my favorite photos is of a waiter carrier trying to sell food to a passenger who's leaning out of the window. And as she holds this tray of food, the passenger is leaning out, but he's looking at his watch. And so you can just see the sort of this juxtaposition of what a train passenger is worried about, you know, time and like, is the train on time?
Mm-hmm.
And the concern of a woman trying to sell food to this passenger who isn't really giving her his full attention.
There was something else I was going to ask you about. Oh, this Gordonsville, Virginia. They have a chicken festival even today. Is that right? Yeah, they do.
Yeah, they have it every year in May.
Okay.
And I realize I just, once again, I missed it. I do plan on at some point going.
I want to go too, man. Yeah, we should meet up there.
Yeah. So it's a big event.
And, yeah.
It's important for the tourist economy there.
Yeah.
And they celebrate it now. And it's interesting because when the Whittier carriers were actually sailing in Gordonsville in the late 19th, early 20th century, there was a concern about the women creating a negative perception of the town. And of course, now it's quite different.
The irony is thick there.
Yeah.
You also have a chapter on the Pullman car company and the maids that worked in these cars and archives. But you also, before we get to the end of that, you also talk about how Pullman cars were expensive, were obviously they were expensive. But they were really important to Black people who could afford them. And you mentioned some people like Du Bois and others who, so can you tell us a bit about the Pullman car and like where it kind of fit in African-American life, both as kind of the labor side of it. And then, you know, if you could afford it, we know what that meant.
Yeah. And I think most people are familiar with how the Pullman company was important for African-American men who became Pullman porters, enabling a sort of middle-class status for African-American men. But I think the Pullman compartment was also important for travelers who could afford a Pullman space. It was important because it was a way for them to travel in some form of comfort. So those African-Americans who lectured widely, for example, Booker T. Washington or W.B. Du Bois, being able to travel by a Pullman car was something really significant because they could relax, they could get work done. And most importantly, if they had a Pullman compartment and if they were, if they could pull the curtain, they wouldn't be harassed by white passengers. So there was definitely a benefit to the Pullman compartment, both as a Black male laborer and also for Black travelers.
And so tell us a bit about, your adventure started with finding this application of this Black woman working at the Pullman thing. And then part of the chapter is about the silences in the archives, right? So what were you able to see and what did you kind of have to read between the lines to see in this chapter on the maids?
Yeah, I think that's an important question. Because one of the challenges to writing this book was just trying to grapple with the fact that initially when I had this question about Black women in the railroad, initially I felt, okay, well, there's nothing there. Where am I going to go to find this information that of Black women traveling and their, how they experienced it. And one of my larger arguments is that, just as a number of Black female intellectuals were forced off of the first class train car, there's a way in which our archives about the railroad and the train, there's a way in which Black women have somehow been forcibly left out of the sort of archival history of the railroad. So I was trying to make an argument about the train car and the archive in both its material aspects as well as more metaphorically, that, you know, in order to find out this information, you know, we have to sort of like read through the margins. Yeah. We have to be willing to sort of look in unusual places and, you know, sort of interrogate those absences. Yeah. Like, what do those absences say? What could they possibly mean in the context of our understanding of U.S. transportation history?
Yeah. Or just the history of technology more generally, right? If we think about the telegraph and all these different systems, you know, I think there's obvious places to start, like black newspapers. I've done some of that around cars and other technologies. But, you know, then we have to get creative, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Is there a way that you, is there something that you found particularly useful in your work when you're studying different forms of technology and trying to highlight unusual experiences?
Yeah, I mean, for me, so I had I might still do it at some point. I've been thinking about like a book on the relationship between the civil rights movement and technology, and so I just kind of, you know, some of it's now in the Bay and Soren books and other places, but I got really interested in the relationship between black people and automobiles and buses, kind of like deconstructing Montgomery, going back and thinking about like the space that people lived in and their relationship to technologies. And then what got me started down that road was in King's memoir about Montgomery, and then also in the kind of big histories of the civil rights movement, the system that came up of cars, right? The carpooling stuff. It was really, you know, King says it was essential for, you know, the boycott working was creating an alternative system of transportation around streetcars and buses. And so, yeah, that just got me really interested in like in those stories, you know, it's like, how does this work? And what, you know, what I find, and that's why I was so glad to find your book, and I'm glad all these books are coming out that I've mentioned, is just the most obvious historical work that you would start with, like black newspapers, plunking in bus or motor coach or whatever it is, and just seeing what's there. No one's done that work even, you know what I mean? And we're like very few people. And so, yeah, this is what I find is we just need to start off with the basics and then turn to all the, you know, all the wonderfully creative sources you draw on, you know? I mean, there's so much to do then, but we got to start off with like, well, first we have to be curious about what black people were, how they were relating to this technology, and just look where you would look and then go from there, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, I think a history of African Americans and the automobile is definitely something worth pursuing, because so many African Americans have talked about how having their own car.
Yeah, right.
Just not having to worry about, you know, people harassing you on a bus, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Totally. Your conclusion talks about this interesting person. Is it Pauli Murray? Is that how you say the
Pauli
name?
Murray.
Yeah. So, you know, tell us a bit about Pauli Murray and also what Pauli Murray's story of the, you know, of the train allows us to see about the train. I thought it was, you had some really fascinating points in that conclusion.
Yeah. Pauli Murray is a really incredible person, poet, scholar, priest, very early was interested in homeowner treatment to have their identity, to have the identity that they desired. I look at Pauli Murray, who actually coined the term Jane Crow. Mm-hmm. Murray did legal work, received a law degree at Howard University, and in their legal research came up with the term Jane Crow to help explain gender and sexual discrimination. Mm-hmm. Murray used the term, you know, in a legal aspect, but I examined how Jane Crow, you know, obviously a sort of it's not just the feminized version of Jim Crow, but instead a way of looking at all of these different travel experiences that I investigate throughout the book. But what's interesting about Pauli Murray is that when Murray was young, a young adult, Murray identified as male and wrote about their different experiences hopping freight cars. And I mentioned before about how rare it was to find some sense of pleasure in a train running experience. Pauli Murray was one other place where I found a sense of sense of freedom, a sense of, you know, all of those sort of romantic notions we have about the train. Curiously enough, I found elements of that sort of romanticization in some of the discussions about the train that Pauli Murray presents.
And what so that allows you to draw out is the gender side of it, right?
And I think that particularly because Murray, by identifying as male while hopping these freight cars, you know, there's a way in which Murray sort of taps into this idea that for Black female train riders, there's that heightened anxiety that we talked about before. And I think presenting as male, you know, offered a, some level of protection while traveling. And curiously enough, there are these two photographs I have of Murray. You know, one of Murray dressed up in a sort of Boy Scout uniform that I included in the book, and then another image of Murray climbing up a freight car. around the 1930s. So again, I think there's something about the visual image of actually seeing Murray on the side of a freight car. You know, and we talked before about the different kinds of train compartments. I think the freight car is very distinctive because it's, you know, it doesn't have the sort of class connotations, first class, second class. And there is a sense of sort of blue collar element to the freight car. You know, it's there's something very utilitarian about the freight car.
But it also allows this, this pleasure to come out. I thought it was great. Mariam, thanks so much. I mean, you know, I really thought, you know, I like to have books that I think have clever methodological things going on, you know, like clever use of sources. And I really loved all the different kinds of sources you draw on and in very creative ways, I think, to stitch together this story, which is not easy to tell because I think that, you know, it's a very, it'd be a lot different if it was about elite white dudes in the first class car. That would be, we could do that pretty fast, you know? So anyway, thank you so much for writing this great book and for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed speaking with you. And
I hope you enjoyed this episode of our podcast. You can reach us with questions, comments, and suggestions at leevinsel@gmail.com or by following me on Twitter at STS_news or on YouTube at People's Things. Our podcast is distributed by the New Books Network, the leading platform for academic podcasts, so that you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Peoples and Things, like most things in this world, depends on the work of many people. I want to thank my brother Jake Vinsel for writing the music for the show. I want to thank my buddy Juliana Castro for designing the logos for the podcast. You can check out her work at julianacastro.co. Joe Fort is the producer for the podcast, and Mandy Lamb is the production assistant. This podcast and other Peoples and Things programming are produced in affiliation with Virginia Tech Publishing and supported by the Center for Humanities and the University Libraries at Virginia Tech. For information about other podcasts from Virginia Tech Publishing, visit publishing.vt.edu. For the entire Peoples and Things team, I am Lee Vinsel. And most importantly, I want to thank you for listening. Thanks.